before we look at the readings of today, I should perhaps note that big image that's here in the sanctuary. That's Our Lady of Fatima. She arrived early. Her first day is, her feast day is tomorrow, Our Lady of Fatima. And a family who's honoring her because of how she has helped them, offered to loan us their image. And I told the man who was going to bring it, I said, well, be sure and bring it before Saturday morning because we won't have a chance to set it up properly. And he couldn't come today, so he came yesterday, or came Wednesday, and brought this big statue. So he said, well, we have it here. We might as well put it in the sanctuary. It's a nice statue, Our Lady of Fatima. So tomorrow we have a big celebration in her honor. It's a Saturday. It's a feast day of Our Lady. It's month of May, so a Marian day. But while I'm thinking of Mary, I'd like to also mention that today is also a Marian feast day in some places, including Muntinlupa, where the patroness of Muntinlupa is Our Lady of the Abandoned. So today, May 12, is her fiesta. And the parish there is celebrating their 160th anniversary today. And they're having a special event. This is important for the diocese because that parish is also the diocesan shrine of Our Lady of the Abandoned. And they're going to have a canonical coronation of the image, which is a pretty big thing because that's a Vatican-approved event. And the papal nuncio is going to the parish today to do this canonical coronation of the image. You might have seen that in the news or in the social media because that's happening here. And when a papal nuncio comes, that's as close as you can get to having the Pope come. So it's like the Pope coming to the diocese, or coming at least to the city of Muntinlupa, 160th anniversary of their parish. Now, since that 160 years ago, this was Spanish territory, Spanish church, and so the Our Lady of the Abandoned was Nuestra Señora de los Desamparados. She has a Tagalog title too, but I can't remember. Can't remember it. I remember the first time I saw that parish. Big sign, Our Lady of the Abandoned Parish, and I thought it was an abandoned parish, and it confused me. I said, "Why was that parish abandoned?" So I was obviously wrong. It's the diocesan shrine of Our Lady of the Abandoned. Well, let's take a look at the readings today. This is the third day in a row we have the circumcision controversy. So we finish it today. The controversy is over. The church has deliberated, has discerned, made a discernment led by the Holy Spirit, and declared definitively, no, the whole package of the Jewish laws is not what's required. Circumcision is not required for salvation, but these other details are required, and that's in the reading. Now, perhaps I've spoken too much about this controversy already and tried to connect it to the various political and social controversies that are still raging nowadays and even in the church. But let me just go back to one point I made yesterday about the inadequacy of the conservative-liberal divide that is so common. Typically, liberals think that the liberal position is the right one and therefore the conservative position is the wrong one, and the same with the conservatives. They think that their position and all conservative positions are the right one, and therefore all liberal positions are the wrong one. The problem is those labels are not very precise, and what happens is once something is established, for example, the law not requiring circumcision, that becomes the conservative position because that's the one you preserve. The conservatives preserve the tradition, and the liberals always they're looking for new developments. And what I thought of was this experience of Pope Benedict. Pope Benedict, when he was a young theologian at the time of the Vatican Council, was considered a very liberal theologian, or in those days they called them the progressives. It was the progressives and the traditionalists. So because he was advocating renewal, a new approaches to theology and to the church, so that the church could speak more effectively to the modern world, and that was also the vision of Saint Pope John the 23rd. So young Father Ratzinger, who was a paritus, an expert guide at the council, was a progressive theologian, which is kind of a funny thing because his reputation now and for the past 30 years is that he's the arch conservative theologian and cardinal and pope. When he became Pope Benedict XVI, he was always portrayed as an arch conservative. He didn't change his position at all. He didn't change his position. So that shows us that those kind of terms like liberal and conservative or progressive and traditionalist, they're relative terms. So when the conversation shifted, he found himself not on the left of the conversation, but on the right of the conversation. So anyway, in this event of the circumcision controversy, you see what they did. They made the discernment about what's required, but they also made a discernment about some additional things. Now, look at what they said. This is what our official decision is. In fact, they say it this way. It is the decision of the Holy Spirit and of us. Isn't that a beautiful way to say it? I mean, this is revealed to us by the Holy Spirit. This is not just consensus, popular, you know, democratic majority rule. This is the Holy Spirit and us, not to place on you any burden beyond these necessities. And they don't even mention circumcision, so, as if that's not an issue anymore. But they mention four things: abstain from meat sacrificed to idols, from blood, from meats of strangled animals, and from unlawful marriage. Now, this is an interesting mixture because some of them are quite serious and are to this day restricted, especially unlawful marriage. That's not it's not based on opinion or popular or social changes. But blood, that's not intrinsically evil to eat something of blood. And so that was a restriction at that time out of respect for the Jews who became Christians and who were so repulsed by the idea of eating blood, so that the Gentile Christians who wouldn't have been maybe so disturbed by it would refrain from it for the sake of the community. So you see, this letter is a mixture of a revelation of permanent principles and some compromises for the good of the community. The one about meat sacrificed to idols, the danger there is, of course, participation in idolatry, which is very serious. That is a grave, and that's still wrong. But meat that has been sacrificed to idols, if it was after the sacrifice sold in the market and you didn't even know it, then it becomes less of a factor. So these things are all, you have to make prudential judgments about them. Notice that the effect of this letter, of this decision, was delight. When the people read it, they were delighted with the exhortation. So there was a if not unanimous, a very broad consensus of a great acceptance of the decision of the Holy Spirit, and that's the basis for the unity of the community. And when people are following the Holy Spirit and they're united in God's will, they can experience joy, delight. That came up in yesterday's gospel. No, Jesus said, I want my joy to be in you and I want your joy to be complete. Well, the only way our joy can be complete is if we're united with one another in God. Delight. In today's gospel, Jesus takes us a step further into this union in love. He repeats the commandment, love one another. Love one another as I love you. This is a continuation of what we've been studying the past several days. What Jesus is giving us is not just more rules. He's giving us a share in his own life. What the life that he shares with the Father. As the Father is in me, the Father loves me, and I love the Father, so you love the Father, follow the commandments of the Father. All this language. So he's saying, love one another as I love you. And then he says, no one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. No one has greater love than this. The greatest love is this sacrificial love, which we immediately associate with the cross, and we should, because that's the image, the cross, the crucifix, shows us the greatest love. He lays down his life for his friends, or he makes us his friends by laying down his life for us. But if you think about it, isn't it true that the greatest love is God's love? And if a God who is love, if he has the greatest love, how could he be laying down his life before he created anything? How could God be the example of love if there wasn't anyone around to love? And this takes us into the inner life of God, which is a communion of love. God was laying down his life in the sense that he was making a gift of himself from all eternity, because God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And each of the persons of the Trinity is making a complete gift of himself to the others all the time. Now, you can't say they weren't dying for each other in the strict sense, because God can't die, he's eternal. But they were completely given over to the other. And that's who God is. He's this dynamism of selflessness, of giving of oneself and of receiving the gift of the other. That's love. And God is love. So when the second person, the Trinity, takes on human nature, the incarnation, he makes visible to us what was invisible before, what was eternal. He gives us a human version of what was always, what is always the reality of God, that love is this pouring out of oneself for the other. That's the greatest love. Now, there are other dimensions of love, of course, he says, but this is the greatest. There's no greater love than this. Divine love, selfless love, self-sacrificing love. Which is a very profound thing to reflect on, because that means that the greatest love is not the love that makes me feel better. That the greatest love is not even about me, except insofar as I can give myself. And so many dimensions of love or depictions of love or ideas about love are so self-centered nowadays that it's essential for us to realize that that's not the greatest love. It might make us feel great, but that's not love. The greatest love is to make a complete gift for the good of the other. Complete gift of ourselves for the good of the other, no matter how it feels. I didn't mention the martyrs that we're celebrating today, but that's what martyrs do. They become representatives of the greatest love, and they don't feel very good about it, but they rejoice in it because their joy is complete. So here we, maybe this is too broad a range. You went from Our Lady of Fatima to Nuestra Señora de los Desamparados to the circumcision controversy, to the whole issue of love. But really, once we get to love, which is God, and we understand how God has made available to us this gift, we see how everything else falls together. Jesus' death and resurrection isn't just showing off to show how powerful he is. No, he's giving us a share in his own life, which is all love. The life of God is all love. It's all gift. And he rejoices to give. So he's giving us an opportunity to participate in this, as painful as it can be, as terrible as the experience of loss can be. We can make all our losses and all our sufferings a gift of love, and therefore enter into the joy of God. So that's where we are in Easter, and we ask the Lord to send us the Holy Spirit so that we can participate fully in this, and we ask the intercession of Our Lady to pray that we enter more and more fully into the joyful dynamism of love.